This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 84 of What's It Like. My guest is Beth Fleener from somewhere in Seattle. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
Did you grow up in that area?
I did not. I originally moved to Seattle from a small town on the border of Tennessee and Virginia called Bristol, which is where I grew up until I graduated high school, and then I came to the furthest point in the continental United States away from that place. That was not the intent or the reason.
You've lost your southern drawl.
That's what I've heard. Although, when I return or when I am on the phone with family, it comes out pretty strong. There's certain things you can't deny.
Right? Easy to fall back into, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you come from a large family?
I wouldn't call it a large family, no. I was predominantly an only child until I actually have a brother and sister who are 16 and 19 years younger than
I am.
My father remarried and has two kids. And so I finally have siblings and, get to have the fun with the siblings, but it's very different in that I didn't have siblings growing up.
And, mm-hmm.
But very close with my extended family. I was raised a lot by my grandparents. So we had a large family in terms of that, aunt, uncle, grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who had the biggest influence on you growing up?
I guess you would say it depends on what angle you're looking at it from. My parents were very, very young when they had me. And so through various things, they divorced when I was actually six. And my mother and I moved in with my grandparents at that point. And so I would say as parental figures, my grandparents were a huge, huge influence. And my grandfather in particular, who was a college history professor. And kind of, I make the joke a lot that he's the Yoda of Southwest Virginia. He's just this really, really beautiful, philosophical, grounded, wise individual that was kind of always and still is, the voice of reason that comes back in my life. But then I was certainly influenced by other teachers and people that I was connected to through that environment. And in particular, as I got into music, that was a pretty big transitional point for me. And so then my band directors through both middle and high school were very influential. And although I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with him, my father is a planetarium director and astronomer. And because my parents were divorced, I would spend the summers with him and I would go to work with him every day, not in a position to pay for a lot of childcare. I would, I would just go tag along and hang out in the museum and in the planetarium. And that experience was incredibly, incredibly influential to spend that much time, in reflection every day about the grand scheme of the universe, basically, was hugely, hugely influential. But I would definitely, if I had to pinpoint a guiding light, I would say that my grandfather was a huge, huge influence.
What was your major challenge as a child?
Major challenge, how to try to summarize something like that. I'm always working with this concept that the words sometimes often fall short of trying to really encapsulate the whole experience of something. We have the same words for widely different experiences, but I had a pretty intense struggle growing up. I think a lot coming from the fact that my parents were very young and they were struggling with their own, with growing up themselves and trying to figure out who they were. And as a result, there was severe impact in my life from that. in terms of their addictions and their relationships to themselves and to other people, and some very difficult factors there. Hmm.
So how did you find your way?
I found music. I actually tried to commit suicide 3 times when I was 11 years old, and because I was just in a constant state of torment and agony, and for whatever reason, you know, each time it didn't take, and I went to therapy after that, and you know, things which I was also very not interested in, and not was not feeling any shift, I guess you would say, through that. Still having a very difficult time, and I had some very close friends, you know, that were kind of saving grace during that time, that were really engaged individuals that loved to play outside and really make up games and have their own experience of the world, you know, instead of just like sitting and watching television or something. And I having those influences was one thing that kept me going. And then the minute that I started playing music, everything changed. Like everything in the world changed. And it became not only this way for me to deal with myself, you know, have some thing that, like, you know, when I was playing, I'm a clarinetist, it's my first primary instrument. And so the minute that the horn was in my mouth, I was no longer having the same kind of thoughts and kind of tormented by the same suffering that I had been having for quite some time. And on top of that, then I started to have this really deep connection to all of the people in the band with me, you know, because I was doing high, at that point, I started beginning band in the sixth grade, and then I did middle school and high school band. And so it was this ability to finally be one part of a greater system and really feel like I had worth and purpose in that greater system. And now that's something I really take into my work on a variety of levels, where it's like you see that in every aspect, whether it's sports or whether it's music or, you know, whatever it is, this team mindset that you make your individual contribution and the whole is better and greater for it. And you can really zoom out and see how much that's what civilization is, you know, that each person has their own individual contribution. And I really started to activate that at that point. And that became, then they became my support system. Those people became my friends and my tribe. And, you know, we hung out all the time when we weren't playing in class, and we would travel for, you know, competitions or whatever. And that became the thing that I really lived for.
You made your own family.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So how far did you go in school?
I have a bachelor's degree. So once I graduated high school, I knew I wanted to be an artist. I knew that I wanted to be a musician. And I also knew that as a clarinetist, I didn't want to play in a symphony orchestra. It wasn't really, not that I had anything against it. It just didn't feel like the thing that I wanted, you know, to do. I grew up on rock music and like growing up in the planetarium in the 80s, it was all laser shows with classic rock. And so, you know, like my favorite bands, I was really into Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and stuff like that. And then I played the clarinet in band, you know. And so there was this kind of disconnect between what I loved and what I felt like the instrument that I was doing. But I really wanted to figure out a way to do what was exciting to me musically. And so I was really interested in learning how to improvise, which at that point I didn't know how to improvise, and I was even too terrified to just like sit in my room and make something up. And so kind of happenstance, I found out about a school here in Seattle, and I had decided at like 14, I went on this trip to London with my band and the high school band for a parade. And I met someone there that we became really good friends, and I really loved it in England. Like, I just felt so calm and comfortable and really liked it. And she said, if you really like it here, then, like, the most comfortable thing you have in the U.S. is Seattle. And so, like, at 14, I was just like, I'm going to go to college in Seattle. That's what I'm going to do. You know, like, I didn't know any schools or know anything about it whatsoever. And I had gone through a series of things where, like, at 16, I moved out of, at that point, my mother and I had a place outside of my grandparents, but because of various difficulties, I left home and lived with friends and tried to live with my father briefly in Florida, which didn't work out. And then I went back and went back to living with my grandparents. And so over the course of all of this, I find out about this school in Seattle that's an art school, Cornish College of the Arts, and got very excited about it because it's like they didn't care what your SAT scores were, and they didn't, you know, they weren't interested in that kind of stuff. So it was really about the art and really cultivating the whole artist, and that was really exciting to me. And so I did a tape audition and got into Cornish, and actually through the series of events that took place through that, I had never been to the school. I had never visited. I had never visited Seattle. I didn't know anybody that taught there. I had no idea about the legacy of the institution or the incredible faculty members that I was going into encounter. You know, I didn't know any of that. I just wanted to go to Seattle, and hit this point where Cornish at that time didn't have dorms, and so I didn't. I had to get an apartment, and I was 17. I hadn't even turned 18 yet, and so I couldn't sign a lease, and we had no money for college, you know, so suddenly it was like, how am I going to do this? But I was really determined, and I actually made the comment to my mom at one point, because we had been rebuilding our relationship, and, you know, we'd have lunch and go to a movie once a week, and we're really rebuilding our relationship, and I said kind of offhandedly, like, I really wish you could go with me. I'm really scared, and, she actually did that. She left her job and moved to Seattle with me so I could go to art school. And then I went to school for 3 years as a performance major, and then at which point I started to get involved in the music business because I was a work-study student in the music office. I answered phones and did filing and things. But then I started to get really interested in the business side of things and got some work as a concert producer or co-producer on a festival, and that kind of started to light the fire in that area. And there is a deeper point to the story. It's long, but it's what happened at that point after 3 years is I had my wisdom teeth pulled, and the doctor caused nerve damage, and I lost all the feeling in the left side of my face, which for a clarinet player was really traumatic experience. And so I took 2 years off at that point and just kind of took a giant step back and had been having this struggle for a long time about, can I make it as a musician or as an artist, or should I just go head first into the music industry and be on that side of things where I can support other people's work? Or, you know, I was really having this intense battle and would go, like, maybe I should just quit playing and just do this other thing. That would come up a lot. But then having this injury that made it to where, like, I had to relearn how to play my instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the nerve, the sensation eventually came back, but over the course of a year and a half, I had, like, that Novocaine pins feeling in my face. And so over this 2 years, I relearned how to play the instrument, and I also went way, you know, further into improvisation because I couldn't play the kind of music that I had been playing, written music. And so all these things kind of coalesced, and I realized that I actually wanted to do both, that I was a person that it wasn't one or the other. It was actually a combination of the two. And so then I returned, after a two-year break, I returned to Cornish. I had been living in Nashville, Tennessee during that period. Just really took a huge step back from everything. But after that, I was like, I'm going back. And there was this fire that happened at that point that has pretty much propelled everything that's happened since. And so I graduated with a bachelor's in 2004.
Did you ever consider not relearning the clarinet?
I did. I did. At that point, too, like on a personal note, I had my boyfriend at the time was living in Tennessee. You know, we had this long-distance relationship. And So I really, when I took that step back, I went home and we got married and I kind of started this whole other life. And there was, you know, I was playing a little bit for fun, you know, with friends, just trying to relearn. There were a couple moments where I really did consider just like, this is, if you want to walk away, you can do that really easily. But it actually, it was almost like the minute that that thought even crept in, there was the answer on the other side, which is just like, you know, you actually know more than ever now that you have to play. That's what makes you the happiest. And like having that, the possibility that that would really just go away entirely was just not acceptable. You know, I couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
So they actually gave me this opportunity to relearn on the instrument things that I did incorrectly originally. Like I didn't have much individual instruction, or, you know, I was one of many people in the class, in the band class. And so I had a lot of bad technique and a lot of things that were actually holding me back. And by kind of getting knocked down a couple notches and having to really take that step back, I had the opportunity to just revamp everything and make it right.
So what exactly do you do?
I am a musician, composer. I play clarinet, percussion, and voice. And that's one side of my personality, is that musical performance side. And then the other side is that I am the founder and director of an arts management company. So I handle concert production, grant writing, publicity, booking, strategic planning, all sorts of things on the business side of music and of arts in general.
For music and art?
Yeah, I work with a lot of dancers and theater artists as well, theater organizations, companies, and nonprofit arts supporting organizations, just kind of a catch-all in the arts world.
Mm. What's the best thing about your job?
That's a really difficult question. You'd think that would be easy, but it's actually a really difficult question. I think really the best thing is the level of connection that I have to the entire world, you know, and whether that's as a performer, as a composer, like the artists I work with, the audiences we engage with, the venues and the presenters, all sorts of different cultures and different cities all over the world, you know, all of that aspect of it. And then as a performer, and then the same thing as a support on the other side, where I get to be involved in all of these projects that I wouldn't normally play in or write for or something like that. You know, I just get to be involved with so many different types of people in so many different places. And with what my focus and interest is, which is the manifestation of the individual voice. And I don't mean that in like in terms of singing. Like every individual has a voice and has a vision and is completely unique. And I'm most interested in the cultivation of that voice. And so by working in the areas that I do, I get to be incredibly connected and engaged with people in a variety of so many parts of that process. Both those that are actively working on it and developing it in terms of artists, and then those that aren't aware that they're developing it through those experiences. Or
let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
It's incredibly stressful and survival in terms of like financial survival and just like taking care of rent and taking care of things like that is incredibly difficult. Because nothing is stable, you know, and there are times where, you know, it's feast or famine a lot of times. So there's this constant stress of even when there's a lot coming in, you know, like when there's a lot of good stable work coming in, it doesn't mean it's going to be like that. It could just be that month, or it could be that week, and, you know, or it could be for a couple months, and then there'll be some months where there's absolutely nothing. And not in terms of the amount of work that I'm doing. I pretty much work around 80 hours a week, every week, and have for years, between the two sides of things. So it's not like, even though you're still doing the work, there's not necessarily compensation or things coming in at that moment. That might be for something that's 6 months or 12 months or, you know, even 2 years away, but you're still having to work on it. And so that can, it has its moments where it really, you know, kind of breaks you. And I've had some moments where I just kind of like crash, you know, and have a lot of crying and a lot of fits and kind of like, but the other side of it, the good stuff is so much so that it keeps my motivation up. And I am finding more and more all the time, I mean, especially like as I get older and as things change, I'm finding more and more systems for adjustment. You know, like here's what I need in terms of sleep, and here's what I need for food, and here's what I need for my health to be able to sustain at a certain pace, you know, to get up and go every day and have the self-motivation, because none of it, that's the other thing about, you know, being freelance, is that everything is dependent on me as an individual. And if I get sick or if I stop or I take, you know, if I want to take a vacation, what's that? I haven't done that for some time. These are things we'd like to introduce, vacation and weekends, you know. But if I don't do that, then nothing is being generated. And that can, you know, maybe that doesn't affect you again like that month, but then 6 months later, there's the ball drops, you know. And so it's just constantly like working on things now and then working way ahead as well, and just like constantly having this rotation of things coming in and going. And that's it's incredibly stressful. But I also thrive in it, you know.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Well, it's interesting, depending on which part of the job you're looking at. They're all, in terms of artists, there are so many types of creativity and imagination, and that comes through in so many forms. And so that, in terms of making a career in it, really motivation, just having self-motivation and great self-esteem, because it's a world where no one is really validating you on a regular basis, and you're constantly having to really be like, no, I have an idea, I want to do this. So really just having like the stubbornness to just keep going no matter what is coming in on the other side, what people are saying, whether they like it or they don't like it, but just like deep amount of conviction and self-motivation. Which really on both sides, but in particular for the artistic side of it. And on the business side, you know, being analytical, being communicative, being able to really articulate ideas, you know, and again, that comes in a variety of forms, you know. And like I believe that every person has a kind of communication, a language that speaks directly to them, and everyone speaks a particular kind of language. And so, you know, a person who works in different types of the music business needs to communicate in a lot of different ways, but you still have to be really on top of everything and very communicative and direct and clear, strategic, analytical.
If one wanted to, how would they get a job like yours?
Well, in a lot of instances, it's stuff that you can just start doing. From the business side of it, to learn, it's great to learn from someone else in terms of just kind of getting the ropes and some connections and things like that. So going to any nonprofit art institution and working administratively, you know, starting, even if it's just starting like I did on the side of the filing and the basics, office basics, you know, like I was restocking office supplies and things like that. So you just start to pick up the language and the activity and the calendar, the way things go, because there's kind of an ebb and flow to the year. And finding things like that in terms of to work for an organization. But then also there's just like, if there's an artist or someone that you really support or like, just really getting involved with their cause and promoting that. And now through with like social media is one of the greatest tools that our industry has ever seen in terms of really connecting to audiences and telling people about performances and things like that. And so being able to just jump in and start supporting somebody in terms of getting the word out about shows, you know, whether that's like postering or flyering or, you know, things like that. And you just start having conversations about what the clubs are, where people are playing, what people are doing, what types of projects people are working on, and starting to learn more and more like that. So there's kind of two, I think, two entry points in that way of either one, getting identified with a particular person that you support, you know, artistically at whatever level of development and assisting or interning or providing support to that, or getting involved with a larger, like, nonprofit organization. And there's several different aspects on that side, too, whether it's general administration or development, which is a lot of fundraising for whether the organization or for new projects, publicity, you know, going and interning or working in a publicity firm and starting out just making, you know, copies of things or whatever, and then kind of, again, learning the lingo and learning the connections and then working your way up. I think one of the things that's beautiful about it is that it's really like just making the commitment that it's an area of interest. And then wherever, whatever your self-motivation is, then is how far you can go with that, really. It's really like the, you know, it's a very like Wild West kind of thing. Anything goes, and if you want to jump into the pool, just start talking to people and letting your interest be known, because everybody needs help with things, you know. Everybody needs help on the business side.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Typical day. I every day pretty much consists of the same components, even though they're in a lot of different order, different orders depending on what's going on. I almost always have a rehearsal, some self-practice time, hopefully a little bit of composition time. Sometimes, depending on the rehearsal schedule, those kind of come and go about today I'm composing or tomorrow I'm rehearsing, and day after that I'll practice at home, you know, but they have some kind of developmental music work. A lot of emails, a ridiculous amount of emails oftentimes. General updates to the calendars, general updates to promotion on the web, you know, updating all of that kind of stuff, making sure that people know what's happening about that night, the show that's happening that night, or what's coming up over the next couple of weeks. I try to get one really good walk of a couple miles in every day. And then nights are usually performances. Either mine or going, again, like going to support other artists or going to meet other presenters or things like that. So that takes place a lot at night. And then other big chunks of writing. I do a lot of grant writing and a lot of publicity. So I'm doing a lot of writing, a lot of press releases, generating a lot of language about the different projects. And I prefer to do that late at night. So usually, like, I'll get up in the morning, I go to email, see what's urgent, what's come through, what disasters have happened, you know, like things like that, and try to, like, fight any fires or things that are on a deadline and take care of that up front. Then I have some food, have a walk, deal with whatever my, like, am I going to practice a little bit or what's, you know, my rehearsals for the day, and then come back, and then I do some more administrating, more emails, maybe, like, I have, like, working on timelines for people and deadlines, just kind of mapping everything out and having it ready to go, then either going to another rehearsal or going to a performance in the evening, and then I come home and do a lot of, I have a home office, and then some interns, and so I come home late at night and then work on a lot of the bulk of the writing, because I feel like it's quieter outside. It's easier for me to just, like, really sit down and reflect and, you know, spend 3 hours crafting a proposal or a strategic plan.
Beth, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I take a lot of fuel from watching my colleagues. And oftentimes, I mean, that's something that I don't actually get to go out and hear as much music as I would like of other people, in particular people I don't know. And so it's something that when I start to have self-doubt or I start to really just get overwhelmed or frustrated, that's the minute that I know I need to stop and go take a deep inhale and take in some more information. And I get incredibly inspired by watching other people in their element and doing what they do and what they are thrilled by, you know. And that usually helps out a lot. I also think travel is good for that. That helps me out a lot, just to kind of step out of the bubble and get a, like, zoom out, use the zoom lens, and be able to really see my place in everything. You know, like, I've certainly had a lot of moments of great self-doubt, and being able to step outside of it, even if it's just to, like, you know, take a drive for the day or something like that, like, just to kind of really remove myself for a second and really reflect on everything and come back to what is it, why are you doing this in the first place? It's to connect to people. Okay, well, go back into it, you know. So there's a lot of coming back to base camp and remembering what the ultimate motivation is, you know. Like, there's no destination in it. If I'm lucky, I'll get to play my whole life. That's the objective. That's the big goal, you know, is to play and to play and present until I fall over. And so there's just, like, seeing other people thriving in what they're doing makes it more inspirational in that way. It's like, just keep coming back to the connection and doing what you're doing. Because sometimes, like, on the artistic side of it, I can start to be like, oh, what I'm not doing, nobody cares, nobody likes it, nobody, you know, like, I'll have those just bad days, and then it's nice to then go be an audience member, you know? And, like, I take an immense amount of pleasure and greatness out of something else that somebody's playing for me, and then that's the reminder that, like, hey, there's somebody that appreciates what you're doing, too.
When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I take a lot of really long walks. I walk between 7 and 10 miles a day.
Oh, my.
And it is, I really swear that the thing that keeps me grounded, it keeps me going. And a lot of things, like, I work in my head or I write in my head musically or words, but at the same time, it's just like being in motion keeps you kind of going through something, you know. It's not stagnant, you're not stopped, you're not getting run over by it. And so it's the way of just, like, walking and breathing. And it's funny because I'm a wind player, so I deal with breath all the time, but then I'll realize that I'm not really breathing. And that's kind of like the fundamental thing for humans is to breathe. You know, it's a very fundamental part of our being, and it's so incredibly important. And it's the first thing that when you're stressed or you're upset or angry or, you know, just any extreme emotion, even on the positive side, it's like the first thing that you're not really doing. You're not getting breath to your whole body. You're breathing really shallow, which just makes it just kind of amps up whatever sensation you're having. And so I found that by, like, taking the walk, I get really into just breathing, and not like in a necessarily even in a conscious way or a counted way or something like that. It's more just like, I'm just walking, I'm taking in information, and I have the opportunity, you know, to breathe a little easier, not so weighted. There are other things, like I go to acupuncture now, too. Actually have acupuncture later today, and oftentimes I do that around tours, before and after tours, and, you know, things like that. And that's, again, that's like a moment where it's an opportunity for me to just go and kind of do nothing for a little bit. You know, I just kind of lay there and surrender to somebody else. And it's like, my job right now is just to just lay here and be calm and breathe. And that does wonders for my system. But the walking is the definitive.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
There have been a couple. I'd say the nerve damage issue was a huge challenge in that way. I got divorced about 8 years ago. That was a huge challenge and a moment of having to really make the choice between what I needed to do for myself and to follow my dream and follow my intuition about what was really right for me, and having to walk away from my marriage, which was very abusive, and it really took me into the deepest part of myself, you know. And I would say the same, you know, it's interesting because there's kind of a correlation between that and also the things that happened with my parents growing up, and you know, just having to keep coming back to the fundamental truth, you know, within myself, which is that I am happiest when I'm playing music,
mm-hmm.
and that's, I'm the happiest and the healthiest when I'm doing that, and outside of everything else that's going on, that is the number one thing that I have to keep doing for myself in order to survive and sustain. And so there's these kind of punches that have come in, you know, to really challenge that and attack that. And I kind of have had to go back to square one again and just be like, but no, I know that this connection, this communication with people, this is where it's at for me. And so that's always the answer, no matter what it is.
Is there an idea or a principle that helps you through your challenges?
I think that, like I said, I think that every single person in the world has a definitive contribution. You know, like there is no one in the world sees the world the way that you do. It's an incredibly amazing, spectacular thing that's happening here with existence, where everybody is experiencing a life is an experience that no one else can experience, that everyone is experiencing simultaneously. You know, like nobody has your perspective of what's going on, but at the same time, we're all participating in this perspective together. And the notion that every single person has a contribution and has an individual voice, and that it's your, I feel like it's your moral obligation to try to clarify what your voice is and what your contribution is. It is something that, you know, it keeps me going, because it's like, well, I know that I have a place. I know that I have a purpose and I have a place. And that purpose is very simple. It's to be who I am. You know, that's entirely what my life is about cultivating and trying to cultivate for other people, is who are you? Let people hear and know who you are. And I really, within that, I think that every obstacle is an opportunity. You know, every single thing that comes up, there's an opportunity to learn something there. And I don't mean that from the, like, put on a happy face and you know, go back and be nice or, you know, something like that. It's more like from every single thing that happens, every challenge or anything that comes up, there's this opportunity for you to make a choice of how you're going to participate in society, how you're going to participate as a citizen, or how you're going to participate as a family member, as a friend, or as a person on every level. And that keeps me really grounded, you know. It's just like, whatever it is, it's going to, there's something to be learned and noted out of that, and it's my job to be who I am and bring that to other people.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
I would say, find your voice. And it's funny to say find your voice, because it's not actually something, I don't think, that you go out and discover. It's something that you've had your whole life. It's in there from the beginning. And it gets covered up, or it gets attacked, or it gets, you know, all these things. But oftentimes you see it in a person, you know, like in 3, 4, 5-year-old, you know, like these certain inclinations that are the thing that they just are thriving on, you know, that's where their bliss is. And those things develop into all these different forms and become all these other aspects of living. But it still comes down to the root of your individual voice and knowing that every human is an incredibly complex system. You know, there are so many aspects, and really finding the thing that brings all of those aspects together and amplifies it, you know, is the thing that's going to sustain the healthiest and happiest life, you know. And if most of your life is made up of work, you know, most of what you do. And so find work that really cultivates and clarifies and articulates and amplifies your individual voice, because then it just becomes this amazing party all the time, I think.
I want to thank Beth Fleener for joining me today. Thanks, Beth. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.